Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today, we're going to be talking about some topics that are very close to home for a lot of emergency dispatchers: stress, suicide, and PTSD. Our guest is a clinical psychologist at the University of Utah in the Department of Psychiatry, who also works as director of training at the National Center for Veterans Studies. He received his PhD from the University of Notre Dame and completed his residency at the Orlando Veterans Affairs Medical Center. His expertise is in cognitive and behavioral therapies for suicide, depression, and PTSD, and he regularly trains clinicians and medical professionals in addition to his research and clinical work. Welcome, Dr. David Rozek.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So before we jump into the discussion about suicide prevention and PTSD, can you just give us a sense of your career trajectory? How did you get into psychiatry, and then why did you end up working with veterans?
Yeah, so I started in undergrad actually researching a lot of different things. I was kind of exploring where I wanted to go with my career. And I took a class on depression actually from a really well-known researcher, Lynn Abramson. And my takeaway from that class was basically we don't know very much about depression. So we have all these kind of common thoughts about depression that are put in the media, like it's a chemical imbalance, but there's actually not research to show exactly what chemicals are, if there is an imbalance or how we impact it. And so that got me thinking, well, we need to know more about this. If we don't know much about it, how do we treat it? Mm-hmm. And so that got me into kind of the depression area, which is where I spent a lot of my grad school time. When I got to grad school, it was really about now, so we may not know a ton about depression, but we don't necessarily know a ton about how our treatments work. Mm-hmm. And so we had therapies that are about 50 to 60% effective, which are great in mental health. However, if I had a surgeon that said I had a 50 or 60% success rate, I probably would choose a different surgeon.
Right.
And so my research trajectory started with how do we understand how these treatments work? And if we can understand how they work, can we make them better? And so I was working on that within depression and ended up doing some of my clinical work with veterans and got into kind of the VA and was working with some pretty high-risk suicidal veterans. And that's kind of where I went with my career, because they're such a resilient population.
Mm.
But they have a lot of mental health issues, and they have a lot of system support out there, but they're not always getting the care they need, and there's some stigma associated with that.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to kind of tailor my work to that area. So I ended up doing my residency at the Orlando VA, and that actually is where a lot of my work is still in veteran population and active duty. But then I realized quite a few veterans actually jump into different first responding jobs. So now I'm kind of spread across veterans, active duty, first responders, kind of the full gamut, including, you know, fire, EMS, law enforcement, dispatchers.
So how did dispatchers come into your view? I mean, how did you become involved with them?
Yeah, so I have a lot of friends in law enforcement, and one of the things that always comes up in our conversations is dispatchers. They play such a key role, and one, they're the first point of contact for people calling in kind of distress and emergency situations, and they have so many roles and responsibilities, and their job is to take the calls, get the information, calm the person down, keep the person on the line, all while trying to get the right emergency services and the information relayed to whether it's law enforcement, fire, medical, or all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I learned from my law enforcement friends is that this is a group that's getting all of these calls and having all of this stress, but there's not a whole lot of support for them.
Yeah.
And so that kind of piqued my interest, because We know in psychology and psychiatry that this continuous exposure to stress is not good for mental health or physical health, and having that support is so important.
So one of the things that we had talked about a little bit was that even though we know that first responders and dispatchers are exposed to trauma, they're exposed to stress, they feel burnout, we know all these things, and yet what we hear a lot is that they seem to have been overlooked or not really addressed very much by some of the treatments that have been out there. And one of the things you mentioned is that PTSD as a concept and treatments for PTSD have actually been around for a long time. Do you have a sense of why there's been sort of a black hole or sort of been overlooked a little bit in the first responder community?
Yeah, I think within the first responder community, and I include dispatchers in that, is that there's this culture of kind of we need to keep going, kind of we can't show weakness. Mm. This is part of my job. And I think also part of that, when we think of veterans, so the veterans have a VA system for them. And I think they deserve that, and you know, with what they put and sacrifice for our country. However, when we think of first responders and dispatchers, we don't have a system in place for them. So oftentimes they have EAP or the Employee Assistance Program,
right,
where they're getting they have the mental health services, you know, and it ranges, you know, it could be 6 to 12 sessions, but we don't necessarily have kind of the rollout of treatment for PTSD within these EAPs all of the time, or the first responders may not know what to look for in terms of treatment. And so I think one of the things that's kind of missing is we have, you know, again, dispatchers, first responders, their job is to constantly be responding to bad things. Every time they're getting a call, or the majority of the time, it's not a good thing.
Right.
You know, we hear those occasional stories where someone's calling in and asking for help on a math problem or things like that. But really, the majority of the calls that they're getting day to day are bad things happening to them. And so I think part of this issue is that there's just not the resources or kind of the knowledge out there saying, like, this is a job, an occupation that is high risk. It's putting you under stress a lot, and we need to focus more on that.
It's interesting. You've addressed a number of concepts there, and I kind of wanted to break these out a little bit. So when we talk about stress, we talk about burnout, I think people have their own concept of what those things mean. And when we talked before, you kind of laid out what makes an emergency dispatcher's job so stressful. And I want to talk a little bit, I've been interested in your work on moral injury, and I want you to kind of break those out a little bit. So what's trauma, and what's trauma exposure, and what's moral injury, and what are the various elements that contribute to the stress that they're feeling?
Yeah, so when we're thinking of trauma, we're really thinking in terms of diagnosis with PTSD as something that's a life-threatening event. And that doesn't mean it's maybe hearing or witnessing or being exposed to a life-threatening event. So thinking of dispatchers hearing the calls where there's a car accident or domestic violence is a great example, where they're getting all of this information where someone is being threatened and they're on the line listening to that situation evolve and hearing all of the details. That's kind of from a diagnostic standpoint. When we think about trauma in general, it's any highly stressful and arousing event. So it could be, you know, being exposed to something. And I'll use some of the same examples. It could be calls that they're hearing that maybe aren't life-threatening, but they're very stressful. Even thinking of someone who's giving birth they're not going to make it to the hospital. Everything may go fine, and they hear kind of the end of that. Maybe the baby's delivered and things go fine, but that's very stressful.
Right.
And it's unknown, right, in those situations. And when we think about moral injury, we think about situations that kind of go against what we've been ingrained in morally. So these can be situations, the common one we hear in law enforcement or veterans is taking a life. The other decisions that we have are where we have to make that decision tree of who do we send, who do we save first. If there are multiple accidents, you know, are we getting the right emergency responders there?
So even the process of triage in and of itself could lead to moral injury in the sense that I have to choose to help some people and possibly not other people.
Right. And even that choice of who am I going to contact first? Who do I think is closest to the incident? And sometimes that's, you know, a guess, or we use the best of our knowledge, but we may choose wrong, or for whatever circumstance that agency may not be closer than another one. And then the person often sits there and ruminates about that and says, oh, that was my fault. And that can lead to a moral injury.
And what's the effect of that kind of moral injury on stress? I know some of the work you've done has kind of correlated that with PTSD. Is that something that has a strong effect on people's PTSD?
Yeah, so we see that moral injury has a little bit different presentation in terms of some of the symptoms. There's a lot of this guilt and shame related to moral injury. And it's interesting, so moral injury isn't a separate diagnosis. It often falls under PTSD. However, treatments for PTSD can impact moral injury and have the same outcome. It's just we're going to focus a little bit differently and focus on that moral injury piece and help target the kind of thoughts underlying that guilt and shame.
And so the way that you've worked to treat these kinds of issues is interesting to me because it's something that's called, I believe, cognitive processing therapy. And you and I have discussed this a little bit. It's interesting because I think a lot of people see cognition or thinking and emotion as two separate and maybe even opposed kinds of ideas. And yet your therapy seems to take cognitive processing or thinking as directly related to emotion. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the things I like about cognitive processing therapy, it's an evidence-based treatment. It's been around for since the 80s. It was originally developed actually for sexual assault and rape and has now kind of been translated and used in combat-related PTSD, military sexual trauma. Again, it's already been done in sexual assault and rape, physical assault. And so it's a really, really cool therapy, and it's very effective. And the reason I like it is it's really kind of a simple idea. And I'm not saying it's a simple therapy because it does take work, but kind of the background behind it or backbone of it is that thoughts, behaviors, feelings and physiology, or what your body is doing, are all interconnected. And so I like to use just a quick example from my own life because it's always fun to, one, embarrass myself, but right. use kind of this example showing how these interact. So back when I was in high school, and I grew up in Minnesota, each high school had their own tradition of when you dropped your lunch tray in the lunchroom. And so my high school would give you a standing ovation. I was brand new to this high school. I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't know a lot of people. I actually had moved to kind of a different area. So I dropped my lunch tray in the first week, and everyone stands up, gives me the standing ovation. And so this is kind of where I can show you how thoughts, behaviors, and feelings and physiology all interact. So in that situation, I started having thoughts of, oh, no, no one's going to like me. Right. I'm never going to have friends. It started spiraling down pretty quickly, like, oh, maybe I should quit high school. I had a catering job, so maybe I could just work my way up in the catering company. As I'm spiraling down in those thoughts, I'm having those feelings of that anxiety and really breaking that down into fear. I was afraid because, again, I'm going to have no friends. This is, you know, the start of my high school career, having some of those thoughts related to those feelings. I'm also sad because, you know, this is first week. This is my first impression. Again, all these spiraling thoughts. I'm angry. I'm angry at myself. Why did you drop the tray? Again, more thoughts. There wasn't anything on the tray. I had a glass and a plate and no food. It wasn't heavy. How could you drop that? I was angry at the crowd. Why are they doing this? Physiologically, or my body, I turn bright red. I'm great at producing pit stains. So now I'm standing in front of the whole lunchroom, also shaking, bright red, and having pit stains in my first week. And behaviorally, I just wanted to get out of there. So I ran out as fast as I can. I avoided. And so it's a really interesting model because all of these areas interact. So as my thoughts were getting kind of spiraling down to, you know, I should quit high school, I should join the circus or whatever, my feelings were getting more intense, and those feelings then were just fueling the thoughts. Physiologically, if we ask anyone to hyperventilate, say, for 45 seconds, and I wouldn't recommend doing this, but if we hyperventilate, we can actually kind of induce those thoughts and the feeling of anxiety. And when we avoid, so in my situation, I avoided, I got out of there, it kind of shut that whole system down because I removed myself from the situation. What we know about avoidance, though, is that when I went back, so I ended up avoiding the lunchroom for about a week, found different places to eat, brought my own lunch. When I went back into the lunchroom, that whole system, those thoughts, feelings, behavior, and physiology all started to spiral down. And so I just made that kind of system primed to kind of set me up for having those negative thoughts and feelings. And so that's kind of where cognitive processing comes from. It says, since all four of those things are related, and we know within PTSD, avoidance is huge, the negative thoughts are huge, negative emotions, and then we know physiologically startle response is huge. If we can make a change in one of those areas, we can impact the whole system.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and so cognitive processing therapy really focuses on how can we shift your way of thinking, because we know within PTSD there's this negative bias in your way of thinking, and we're not positive psychologists. We're not saying, hey, the world is sunshine and rainbows. We know it's not, but we're saying let's put you back to neutral so that you can evaluate situations on a neutral level in a balanced way.
Instead of having that automatic negative response because of the thoughts that you're having.
Exactly.
And so can you walk us through a little bit? You have a specific program that you use. I believe it's like a 12-session program generally. Can you just talk us through a little bit of what that looks like for the person who's in the therapy?
Yeah, so cognitive processing therapy is a 12-session protocol. And so we have a couple different programs at the National Center for Veterans Studies that are open to dispatchers, first responders. It's all free, also veterans and active duty folks. And so we have a couple different programs. One is kind of the weekly, or we can do twice weekly sessions. And we also have an intensive 2-week program. And so what the therapy looks like overall, the 12 sessions follow a protocol. And I always like to mention that although there's a protocol, it's very individualized. No one session looks the same for everyone. But what we do is we start with just some background on PTSD and how your way of thinking may change. Then we kind of help individuals identify their thoughts and their feelings to kind of separate those. Because that's actually a really hard skill to differentiate or to figure out what are thoughts versus feelings. Because a lot of times we say, I feel, and then it's actually a thought, right? And we want to link the negative thoughts with the negative feelings. And then we take a step-by-step approach where we teach skills to help the individual kind of reframe their thinking into a more balanced way of thinking. So we challenge the negative thoughts. And sometimes there's evidence for these negative thoughts, but they may not be as bad as we thought they were. It's a step-by-step approach that like I said, it has a lot of evidence behind it, and it's not overwhelming. In cognitive processing therapy, we don't necessarily spend a lot of time talking about the actual different traumas unless it's helpful for the individual. We're going to talk a lot about the thoughts related to the trauma, but it's not necessarily let's write out the trauma, because that can be hard for a lot of people. And so we really think of it as a way of retraining your way of thinking specific to those thoughts that stemmed or started from the traumatic event.
And what kinds of thoughts do people generally have in response to those events that you're specifically dealing with?
So we kind of think of thoughts at different levels. So sometimes there are very situationally specific thoughts. And so like, I should have done more in this situation. And ultimately, what we look for are kind of patterns in the way of thinking. And a lot of times those patterns boil down to things like, I'm worthless, I'm not good enough, I'm broken. And so we look for those patterns and we point them out. I like to tell people I'm not a magician when I do therapy. Everything that I do is transparent. And I know a lot about how to change your way of thinking, but I don't know a lot about your thought process. And so you're the expert on you. I'm the expert on change, and we can work together to kind of create this change for you.
Hmm. And one of the things you mentioned when we talked earlier that I found really interesting was that you should be able to teach the technique to the person you're working with. Why is that important? What does that mean?
Yeah. So my goal in therapy and within cognitive processing therapy is to really set up the individual that I'm working with to be their own therapist, to have these skills. I want them to know kind of the background. Now, I'm not going to bore them with research studies, mm-hmm. but I want them to know kind of why I'm doing what I'm doing each step of the way so that when they leave therapy, they have kind of all of the skills and background to implement it if something else were to come up.
Mm.
My goal is, it's not that I don't want to see them back. I don't, because I want them to have kind of the skill set. And we know that within life, stressors come up. We know that a lot of people are exposed to a lot of different stressors throughout their life. And we know that's even more so with dispatchers as well as first responders. And so I want them to be able to translate the skills to the next thing that comes up so that they don't necessarily have to be in therapy for the rest of their life, but they can translate the skills to whatever happens in life.
And you've seen, I believe you said, positive outcomes from this therapy with veterans. Have there been any studies in first responders or dispatchers?
So there haven't been a lot of studies. There are a few case studies out there in first responders. We are working on putting together kind of a larger clinical trial for first responders and dispatchers. We've worked with a few dispatchers, quite a few law enforcement and some fire. But that's one of the things that we're kind of missing within the literature in terms of research. Now, I would say that these therapies like cognitive processing therapy, another evidence-based treatment is prolonged exposure, will work for dispatchers as well as first responders. But what I always like to say as a researcher is it's great to kind of get the evidence and show that. And also if there are any adaptations that need to be made for kind of the different cultures between first responders and dispatchers.
So then it sounds like if you're developing a clinical trial, are you looking actively for participants in that trial?
We are. And so one of the things that we provide this free treatment through our clinic, and what we kind of ask, and it's not required, is we ask that the individuals that go through treatment are willing to kind of share some of their symptom scores. It's all de-identified, no names attached, doesn't get set. It's all aggregate data that we look at. But that helps us kind of show proof of concept that this is working. And I'll be totally transparent. When we do therapy, we track symptoms and we track how people are doing. We ask them how they're doing. And we look at that session by session and share that with the person we're working with because we want to see how things are going.
Right.
So it's kind of part of the therapy already.
So for this particular trial, does this have to be people who are physically able to attend your clinic here in Salt Lake City?
So right now we only have the in-house clinic. We don't have telehealth, although we're working on it. Telehealth is just a little bit tricky in terms of getting the technology set up, but we're on our way to have that because that's our ideal, is to be able to reach people kind of throughout the state. And even it gets a little bit tricky when you're across state lines, we want to be able to have that service, and we're looking into it now.
So if people want to get involved and they're local, how can they get involved in your study? And then for those who are listening who aren't local here in Salt Lake, where can they find a program that might be informed by this? Or how can they identify a program that they can seek out that might give them the same kind of treatment?
Yeah, so locally, the easiest way to get a hold of us is our website, which is veterans.utah.edu. On that page, there's a link right to our clinic. And although that we are called the National Center for Veteran Studies, I want to make it very clear, and we try to do this on our website as well, that we've really branched out into the dispatchers and first responder world too. And so on that homepage, there's a clinic website where there's a form that you can just fill out. It'll allow us to contact you, and then we'll get you in. And we have a great staff and clinicians that have great availability to work around schedules. From a national standpoint, there is a website for cognitive processing therapy. That's cpt4ptsd.com.
Okay.
And I always recommend that website because they have a list of certified clinicians.
Okay.
And so you can look by state or you can look by zip code. That's typically where I tell people to start. Otherwise, contacting us via email or through our website, we have a network that we work with that we might be able to provide referrals as well.
Okay. That's terrific. Yeah. So those are resources for people to access a therapy that's been demonstrated to be pretty successful in at least other groups of people, and you're demonstrating it now in dispatchers.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go, I just have one more question, which is for people who are struggling with this, for dispatchers who are struggling with these issues, for their managers, what's something that they can do right now for themselves to try and deal with some of these stress issues that keep coming up in their work?
Yeah, one of the biggest things that we talk to people about is really the self-care. Figuring out something that you can do nice for yourself to take some time to kind of recover, whether that's doing something like doing a staycation or a small trip, or even just taking some time daily to kind of decompress. So some people like to even take 5-10 minutes to listen to some music before or after work. That's kind of the biggest thing. And then kind of the second piece that we recommend is really kind of maintaining those social relationships and friendships. Reaching out to other people. And that doesn't mean reaching out and saying, hey, I'm struggling, or hey, I'm having some problems with work. It can be for some people, but some people don't want to talk about that. But it's really making those connections and kind of maintaining friendships and getting out and doing things.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us. This is a fascinating topic, and we'll definitely be hearing from some dispatchers and sending them your way for the study. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.